who are committed to overcoming these challenges. Without the proper help, your child is at risk of being left behind. But with our proven technology, your child can flourish as a reader.
Eddie can now read, he's processing, he's understanding, and he's retaining. His grades are going up too.
To find out if your child is eligible, call now for a free consultation. Space is limited. Call the USA Reading Clinic at 800-708-8652. That's 800-708-8652. 800-708-8652.
Obama campaign official Stephanie Cutter says the budget plan offered by Congressman Paul Ryan is not good for the country. This audio is courtesy of CBS's Face the Nation.
The Romney-Ryan budget is not a budget for growth and prosperity. It's a budget for redistributing wealth to the top.
Romney campaign senior advisor Eric Bernstrom sees it differently. This audio, again, comes from CBS's Face the Nation.
A substantive campaign conducted on the high ground is going to trump the type of petty, negative politics that we're hearing from Barack Obama.
Police say a chimpanzee who rampaged through a Las Vegas neighborhood last month made a second escape from her backyard enclosure. The Las Vegas Sun reports a resident called authorities about 4:50 p.m. Saturday to report that the chimp had broken free from her cage. This time she will not be returned to her owners but secured at a local zoo. For the latest news and analysis, log on to irnusanews.com.
If you're like me, every time you see an ad on TV about feeding hungry children, it touches your heart. You know children are starving. You want to do something, but things are pretty tough here right now. Go to usagoodness.com and find out how you could help feed hungry children while earning extra money to meet the needs of your own family. How great is that? I'm Andy Willoughby, and we'll show you how to be a social entrepreneur. Go to usagoodness.com or call 800-301-6177, 800-301-6177.
As the 2012 Summer Olympics wind down, correspondent Kyle McKinnon reports there were some minor incidents for security personnel to handle before and during the Games.
An Olympic security trainee was charged with making a bomb threat ahead of the Games. Three Muslim men were charged for heckling soldiers guarding Olympics venues. And 2 weeks before the Games, the company hired to provide most security at the venues had to admit it was well short on security workers. But the military stepped in to make up the difference.
A U.S. Navy ship has collided with an oil tanker in the Persian Gulf. Correspondent Carlotta Bradley brings us more on the story.
The Navy says one of its guided missile destroyers collided with an oil tanker early Sunday, but no one was hurt. The collision involved the USS Porter and a Panamanian-flagged bulk oil tanker. Damage to the destroyer is being evaluated, and the incident is under investigation. The USS Porter is on deployment to the U.S. 5th Fleet, based in Bahrain.
The New York Times says that Transportation Security Administration officers at Boston's Logan International Airport are alleging that a program intended to help flag possible terrorists based on passengers' mannerisms has led to racial profiling. The report says that in interviews and internal complaints it has obtained, more than 30 officers involved in the behavior detection program at Logan. Operation not only targets Middle Easterners, but also passengers who fit certain profiles. With IRN USA Radio News, I'm John Russell.
Hey everybody, Jay Farner here from Quicken Loans. Right now, Quicken Loans is proud to offer you our exclusive Yourgage, a mortgage that's custom fit for you. It's a fixed rate home loan that allows you to select a term that works best for your individual needs, anywhere from 8 to 29 years. The rate today on our 8-year fixed Yourgage is an amazing 2.75%, APR 3.47%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN. We'll help you keep more of that hard-earned money in your pocket where it belongs. Maybe that's why, for the second year in a row now, J.D. Power & Associates ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination in the nation. It's really this simple. I believe there's never been a more perfect time to refinance or purchase than right now. Again, the rate today on an 8-year fixed mortgage is an amazing 2.75%, APR 3.47%. So give us a call today at 800-QUICKEN. That's 800-QUICKEN, or visit us at quickenloans.com.
For J.D. Power & Associates award information, visit jdpower.com.
Well, Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirschner. Today we're going to be bringing you a very special show, a little different from our usual. The modern animal rights movement has benefited greatly from the efforts of lawyers and legislators. Over approximately the past 35 years, animal law was born and has grown to a powerful force to help non-human animals, their welfare, and indeed their rights. This hour is dedicated to the history of animal law in the United States from the viewpoint of a woman who was there at the beginning and indisputably has been an important force in the maturation of animal law. And of course, I'm speaking of no one other than Joyce Tischler. Joyce is an attorney who co-founded Animal Legal Defense Fund and served as its executive director for 25 years. Now she serves as ALDF's general counsel. Welcome to the program, Joyce.
Thank you, Lori.
Joyce, so having read through some of the papers you've written on the history of animal law, I know you like to begin with the ritual slaughter case and Professor Henry Mark Holzer. Recount those events for us, please.
Sure. Henry Mark Holzer is a prolific author, really quite a brilliant man. And back in 1972, he was a professor at Brooklyn Law School in New York City, and he focused on constitutional, administrative, and appellate law. And he was having dinner with Alice Harrington, who was then president of Friends of Animals, and she described to him a federal law, the first federal law to protect animals going through slaughter, animals having anything to do with farming. It was passed in 1958, and it's called the Humane Methods of Livestock Slaughter Act. And this law specifies that in order for slaughter to be considered humane, before the animal is bled to death or cut, the animal has to be rendered unconscious and insensible to pain. At the same time, the act defines ritual or kosher slaughter or halal slaughter as inherently humane, and it specifically exempts ritual slaughter from the protections of the act, which is very interesting. It's contradictory, and it was the result of a political compromise. And I realize that this is a very, very, very touchy subject, whether kosher slaughter is inherently humane or inhumane. So we have to go back in history for a bit, in fact, quite a while. In ancient times, kosher slaughter was considered humane because the animal would be held down on the ground, held still, and his carotid artery in the throat would be slit, and that would quickly produce unconsciousness. The problem came about as a result of modern American health laws, which preclude holding the animal on the ground. So slaughterhouses developed what's called the shackle and hoist, or the chain and shackle method, where the animal is chained by a rear leg, hoisted up into the air, and then someone comes along and slits the animal's throat. And this is actually, in my opinion, inhumane. The animal struggles, hips dislocate, sometimes the artery is not cleanly cut. I've watched this method, and it can be pretty grisly. So the question is, why did Congress compromise on this point? Why did they find this method humane? And it's pretty easy to understand. This law was passed in the late 1950s. It was a little over a decade after the end of World War II and the Holocaust. And Jewish leaders reminded Congress that one of the first laws that had been passed by the Nazis was a ban on kosher slaughter. So opposing an exemption was politically naive, and it would doom this first piece of federal legislation. So the sponsors of the bill made the requested compromise, and the law was passed. Holzer, when he found out about this, said, well, but it's not constitutional. And he filed what, to my knowledge, is the first animal rights lawsuit. And it's a lawsuit that tested that tension between the protection of animals and a long-held religious custom. The suit was called Jones versus Butts. It was filed in 1972, and in it, Holzer and his plaintiffs alleged that the provisions of this federal law relating to ritual slaughter were unconstitutional as written and as applied because they provide separate treatment and protection to the dietary preferences of a given religious group as opposed to general provisions. And the court held against the plaintiffs. The court said the Humane Slaughter Act does not violate the U.S. Constitution. And so the outcome of this case showed us very early on something that we've seen repeatedly in cases in which we're attempting to protect animals, and that is that when human interests are involved, they trump the animal protection in many, if not most, cases. You know, we took a practice, or Holzer rather, took a practice that was clearly inhumane, but the human beings who were sitting on that court were not going to overturn the will of Congress on a politically sensitive issue. To paraphrase what my colleague Matthew Liebman says, the outcome of a case often is dependent upon what the judge, what or whom the judge ate for breakfast.
Yeah, wow. Now, Joyce, philosopher Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, was published in 1975. How did this impact the development of animal law?
In every possible way. I was in law school in 1975, and I remember reading that book, and it was transformative for me. I had always been an animal lover, self-described. Singer gave me a set of philosophical principles to hang my hat on. Steve Wise read the same book. Steve Wise, who is now the president of the Non-Human Rights Non-Human, okay, I won't even bother with it, but Steve Wise,
okay,
who worked
okay.
solely on rights at this time, started with animal law when he read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. I think many, if not most, of the people currently involved in animal law can point back to Singer's book as that formative moment when they got a sense of, oh, yes, there's a philosophy here. It makes sense. It's logical. It follows, and I can hang my hat on it.
Yeah. And then a big milestone, the first animal law class, Joyce, which was in Seton Hall in 1977. How did that come about?
When I was in college, I went to Queens College in New York City, and one of the people who I met there was a woman named Jolene Marion. And the way that we met was that we cared for some cats who were on campus. We didn't have a word for what they were at the time, but many of them were feral. You couldn't touch them. But we provided care and medical care and tried to find homes for as many cats as we could. Jolene graduated several years before I did and went on to law school, and then we lost track of each other. But while she was in law school, she had the vision to understand that there should be something called animal law, and she talked one of her professors into teaching an animal law course. It was only taught that one term, actually, and then it ceased to be. But Jolene, after law school, went to Pace Law School and talked them into having an animal law course. And early on, there were just a few people like Jolene who had that vision of, we need to teach what's going on in the courtroom to students who are going through law schools. And so early on, those classes were taught intermittently, taught by people like Jolene, who were willing to put together their own course materials. It wasn't until the year 2000, far later, that two important things happened. One was that four people actually got together and wrote the first case book. And to teach a course in a law school, you really need a case book. Without a case book, you're putting together hundreds of pages of materials. It's burdensome and difficult, and it doesn't look like a real class, whereas you have a case book, that's a class. The second thing that happened that year was that our organization realized that we needed to focus our energies and resources into getting animal law taught throughout the United States. And our goal back then was to get animal law taught in every ABA-accredited law school. There are about 200. At this point, we've got 142 animal law classes being taught, and there are 171 student groups in the U.S., which are chapters of our organization. So we've done a lot since 2000 in terms of mainstreaming animal law as a class taught in law schools.
So interesting. And, Joyce, to think about that, this just all started like 40 years ago.
Yeah. I like to joke, I'm still alive, so it can't be that old.
That's good. So we're speaking with Joyce Tischler, and this is quite interesting. We're talking about the history of animal law. Joyce is an attorney who co-founded Animal Legal Defense Fund and has served at as its executive director for 25 years. So don't go away. We're going to talk more about the history of animal law with Joyce. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner, and you're listening to Animals Today.
Every day in the United States, tens of thousands of puppies and kittens are born. Unfortunately, there aren't enough homes for all these cats and dogs. One unfixed female cat and her offspring can be the source of more than 400,000 cats in 7 years. One female dog and her unfixed offspring can produce about 67,000 puppies. Too many cats and dogs are unwanted anywhere by anybody, so they end up being neglected or abandoned. Millions of healthy pets are killed in shelters annually. In the U.S., on average, 70% of the animals that enter the shelter end up getting euthanized. Fortunately, there is good news. There's a new answer to this dilemma. We can help to stop killing these animals by having our pets spayed or neutered. If you want a new pet, how about adopting one? You can rescue a cat or dog and save a life. For more information, please visit our website, desertpaws.org. Again, that website is www.desertpaws.org. And save a life. Save a pet's life today.
Owe $10,000 or more to the IRS that you can't pay? Call now for immediate help. 866-657-8517. At Community Tax Relief, we help consumers like you. If you take on the IRS alone, you could be facing levies, liens, even wage garnishments, personal or business tax issues. If you owe the IRS $10,000 or more, they will aggressively come after you. Protect yourself and your family today from what the IRS can do to you. Call now, 866-657-8517. They can freeze your bank account, even garnish your wages. Our expert team of tax professionals can solve your tax problems once and for all. Call now for a free 5-minute tax debt analysis. 866-657-8517. 866-657-8517. 866-657-8517.
Hey, guys, remember when you were 18 with boundless energy and the stamina to do anything you wanted, anytime? Wish you could relive your glory days and have the testosterone of your teenage years with the experience and skill you have today? Now you can with ProGene Daily Complex.
This is Dr. Todd Karen from the American Academy of Anti-Aging and Regenerative Medicine. Testosterone levels decrease in men after the age of 20. It's a major cause of the aging process. The effects include lack of energy, decrease in muscle mass, increasing belly fat, and decreased sexual performance, all of which impacts self-esteem, confidence, and most importantly, overall quality of life.
Kick your drive back into high gear with ProGene. Call 800-516-7457 today to get a full month absolutely free. No injections, no prescription needed. ProGene is an all-natural herbal supplement that helps men naturally produce more testosterone. Claim your free month supply now by calling 800-516-7457. That's 800-516-7457. Again, 800-516-7457. Shipping and processing fees apply.
E-discovery laws and government regulations require that certain businesses save electronic communication, namely emails, or face potential fines. Barracuda Networks, the world leader in content security, application delivery, and data protection, with more than 130,000 customers worldwide, can help. The Barracuda Message Archiver indexes and preserves all email communication while enforcing policies for regulatory compliance. Save email. Avoid penalties. Visit Barracuda.com/archiver to try the Barracuda Message Archiver free for 30 days. That's Barracuda.com/archiver.
All right, Flo, so the key to safe pest removal is staying calm.
Okay.
Says here this lady's got a badger in her attic.
Oh, I love badgers. Oh, sorry. Calm. There he is! Come here, little buddy. I thought he wanted a hug.
Badgers don't really hug.
Not yet. Oh, badgers.
Insuring your business vehicles with Progressive is like having Flo on the road with you. Low down payment, great discounts, and flexible billing options. Now that's Progressive. Visit Progressive.com today. United Financial Casualty Company and Affiliates.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We're speaking to Joyce Tischler, and she's teaching us all about the history of animal law. Joyce, now your organization got its start with the name Attorneys for Animal Rights. Describe those events and who was involved at the time.
Sure. When I graduated law school, there were no jobs in animal law. There were no classes. There were no case books. There was really a blank sheet. And I had written a law review article when I was in law school about legal rights for non-human animals. It was always in my gut, but I had no place to put it. I had no place to place it. I had to get out of law school, pay back the loans, get a job, grow up, all of those adult things that one does. I moved to San Francisco and did get a job and was doing standard legal work, but volunteering for the Fund for Animals in my free time. And Virginia Hanley, who ran the San Francisco office, came to me at one point and said, "I've met another lawyer who's interested in animal rights. Do you want to meet him?" And I said, "Sure," having no knowledge of another lawyer who was interested in this. And his name is Larry Kesnick. He was a partner in a firm. And the two of us met and thought, well, if there are two of us, perhaps there are more out there. And this was back in late 1978, 1979. So we put an ad in the legal newspaper, and six people showed up. And so we began to meet monthly, and we gave ourselves the name Attorneys for Animal Rights. But it was just a little group of people, a little group of lawyers, meeting once a month in San Francisco. And at each meeting, one person would prepare a report on some federal law or some California law that related to animals or some recently published book. And by this process, we taught ourselves about a wide variety of legal issues related to animals. Within a couple of years, Henry Mark Holzer, the attorney I mentioned earlier, got in touch with us and said, "I'd like to put you on this mailing list I have," and we said, "Absolutely sure." We met a woman named Marcel Philpott Bryant, who was a Los Angeles attorney, who was doing some pro bono, which means free, litigation for the Fund for Animals. And when she saw what we were doing, she started a little chapter in Los Angeles. And then I got back in touch with Jolene Marion, the woman I had been a college classmate of, and we had done our little campus cats work together. And she had started a group in New York. So little by little, and this was before the Internet, before fax machines even, this was back in the late 70s, early 80s, we were beginning to find each other. David Faber, who was a law professor, he's at Michigan State University, was a property and environmental law professor, and he was starting to think about the issue of animal rights. He wrote an article called Wildlife Rights, in which he was shifting from the traditional environmental law perspective, which views animals as groups or species. He was beginning to think of them as individuals. And then in 1979, Steve Wise, who is currently with the Non-Human Rights Project, read Animal Liberation. He thought, this is compelling. Peter Singer's making a wonderful argument here. And so he took a vet malpractice case, and he kept taking those cases and talking about animal rights on local radio shows. So there were pockets of interest in various parts of the country. What it took was someone to say, we need to bring all of these people together, and that was Henry Mark Holzer, who in 1981 held the first animal law conference in New York City on Thanksgiving weekend and brought us all into the same room. And at that conference, Larry and I, Hank told us, you've got to go national. You've got to occupy the field, which I thought was amusing. There were so few of us, what field was there to occupy? But we listened to Hank, and we went to this conference, Larry and I, and said, we are forming a national board of directors for Attorneys for Animal Rights. And Steve Wise and David Faber and Jolene Marion and several other people joined our board. Hank Holzer declined at that time. He was too busy. And then we started operating on a shoestring. In fact, there wasn't even a shoestring. We just started operating as a so-called national organization. It was really just a dozen people who shared this interest and this passion, and began to talk and dream together about what kind of cases could we take, what could we do to move from where we were then, which is animals are property, they have absolutely no rights, to a world in which their interests would be protected.
When and why did Attorneys for Animal Rights become ALDF?
Actually, that was a purely financial decision. Attorneys for Animal Rights really described who we were and what we believed in, but we were starving. We didn't have any money, and we realized that if it was ever going to be anything other than a nice idea, we were going to have to learn how to fundraise. And there's another old joke that if you want to have a board of directors that knows how to fundraise, you don't go to the law schools, you go to the business schools, because that's where they learn how to handle money. We were a group of attorneys. None of us came from money. We didn't have silver spoons in our mouths. We knew nothing about how to fundraise, and we were not fundraising. We were trying to do this work, but we needed money to do it. We needed computers, ultimately, and this is way back when, before there were computers. We needed typewriters. We needed legal secretaries. We needed to be able to do this work full time, or it simply wasn't going to happen. And we had initially gone to the large organizations, NSPCA, ASPCA, HSUS, to say to them, okay, if you were to give us a pot of money, like a few $100,000, here's all the litigation we could do for you. And they were not interested. They didn't share the vision of a group that could do litigation for the entire movement. And so we turned to something that people decry, and it's called direct mail, and it's those letters you get in the mail, and it's how most nonprofits that are of any size operate. That's the base of where they get their money from. They go out to the general public, they describe the work they do, and they say, please support us. And so we wanted to start doing that, but the consultant we went to said, well, you need to change your name. People don't like attorneys, they don't trust attorneys, and animal rights is too radical. That's how we changed our name. That's how we became the Animal Legal Defense Fund, based on Sierra Club's Legal Defense Fund, NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. We thought, okay, we want it to be clear that we are a group of lawyers without actually saying that. So, it's stuck ever since.
And you and your colleagues grappled early on with developing policy statements for the organization. What was being proposed, and why did you not adopt policy positions?
That was an interesting process. Very early on, we had lengthy discussions about what is going to be our policy as an organization. And David Favor, the law professor from Michigan, was the one who led that charge. And he said, we really need to have a set of statements that people can look at and say, aha, this is who you are. And he put that out to that early board of directors, and no one really responded until Roger Galvin, who was the person who had, at the trial level, successfully prosecuted, the only successful prosecution against a researcher who abused animals, and that was the Taub case, and it was reversed on appeal. But Roger Galvin wrote back, and our communications were either by phone or letter at this time. That was how we communicated. So Roger Galvin wrote a letter back saying, well, we need to establish what are fundamental and essential rights for all sentient beings. And he put forward that they should have a right to live out their lives according to their nature and their instincts.
Joyce, I'm going to interrupt you because we have to take a hard break. Don't go away.
Okay.
We're talking to Joyce Tischler.
As temperatures climb, please remember to never leave your dog in the car, not even for a minute on a warm day with the windows cracked and in the shade. The temperature inside a car can climb up in a matter of minutes, and it's enough to kill your pet. If you love your pet, leave them at home or with someone you trust. Keep them cool, comfortable, and alive. And if you see a dog or other pet in a car, you may only have a moment to save their life. Here are a couple of steps that you should remember. Make an announcement in the store or business the car is parked nearest to. and call the police department or animal control right away. Remember, it only takes a minute or two on a hot day to kill an animal left inside a car. Your swift action can save a life. Dogs are unable to cool themselves the way people can. Never leave your dog in the car, not even for a minute.
This message is presented by Desert Paws. Visit them online at desertpaws.org. That's desertpaws, all one word, .org.
Musicians, this month is Guitar Center's 48th birthday. We're celebrating with special anniversary deals, financing, sweepstakes, and more. And this weekend, it's Guitar Center's Big Bash. Now through Sunday, get birthday deals like Newmark DJ To Go controllers, just $39, our lowest price ever. Kohala Soprano ukuleles, just $29. Plus, save $50 on Sterling Studio mic packs, just $49. That's how we get the party started, and we'll keep it going while supplies last. Guitar Center's birthday weekend event, now through Sunday.
Whoa, whoa, shark, shark,
shark!
Shark Week.
25 years, and it's bigger than ever. A shark the size of a Greyhound bus.
T-Rex wouldn't have a chance against this thing.
And one that flies. The 25th anniversary of Shark Week starts Sunday at 9, only on Discovery.
Jay Farner here from Quicken Loans. We've got a program with an interest rate that's dramatically lower than the current rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage. It's called our 7-1 adjustable rate mortgage. The rate today on a 7-1 ARM is an amazing 2.625%, APR 2.94%. This incredibly low rate is locked until the year 2019. After that, it may adjust once per year. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN. We'll help you keep more of that hard-earned money in your pocket where it belongs. Maybe that's why, for the second year in a row now, J.D. Power & Associates ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination in the nation. I believe there's never been a more perfect time to refinance or purchase than right now. Again, the rate today on a 7-1 ARM is an amazing 2.625%, APR 2.94%. So give us a call today at 800-QUICKEN. That's 800-QUICKEN. Or visit us at quickenloans.com.
For J.D. Power & Associates award information, visit jdpower.com. Adjustable rate subject to change. Call us for cost information. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Hello, everyone. Domino's here. There's a sound you should get used to for the next week. That's right. We love our customers, and we're not above a little kissing up. And that's why we have a ridiculously good deal. We're giving you half off any pizza when you order online. Go to Domino's.com, select the coupon, and get any pizza for 50% off menu price. But hurry, it's for 1 week only, August 6th through August 12th. Oh, yes, we did.
Online only. Limited time offer. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary. Offer applies to the pizza portion of your order only.
And now Geico presents 30 Seconds with Maxwell the Pig.
Hey, everyone. I'm Maxwell, and my life is kind of awesome because whenever Geico wants to talk about their new mobile app, they're like, hey, Maxwell, you feel like coming to the studio and talking about how the app lets you manage your policy, you know, and get roadside help and even customize it with your favorite Geico character? And I'm like, maybe. Are there going to be snacks?
Everything you love about Geico, now mobile. Download the new Geico app today.
Almost done with the hors d'oeuvres. Soufflés are ready. Hey, Flo, how are those cupcakes coming?
Putting sprinkles on the last one now.
Great. Hey, I thought we had another tray of the red velvet. Have you seen it?
Me?
What? Why would you?
There's frosting on my face, isn't there?
Yep.
Insuring your business vehicles with Progressive is like having Flo on the road with you. 24/7 live support, online bill pay, and expert claims. Now that's Progressive. Visit Progressive.com today. United Financial Casualty Company and Affiliates.
At Grainger, we understand running a facility means wearing a lot of hats. One minute you're replacing a condenser fan motor, the next you're swapping out fluorescent bulbs. That's why we offer over 900,000 products in 31 product categories. Many ready right when you need them, from HVAC equipment to safety supplies. Whatever you need, even if it's a new hat. Yeah, we've got those too. To help keep your business running efficiently, call, click Grainger.com, or stop by a branch today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We're speaking to Joyce Tischler. Joyce, just before the break, you were talking about the issue of developing policy statements. Please summarize that for those who are just tuning in.
Early on, we felt a pressure to develop policy statements for the organization, and we had extensive discussions, but what came out of those discussions was a realization that the people on our board were not of one mind on the issue of abolition versus regulation, on the issues of rights versus welfare. And we had to grapple with that as a new young agency. Were we going to have a pure doctrine that some people were going to feel excluded by, or were we going to advocate for broad social change without policies in order to attract and keep a broader base of support? We opted to not have policies and to not state positions, but rather to represent the positions, as attorneys do, of our clients and to try for a broader base. And we realized early on that we are different from other activist organizations. If we're representing PETA, we want to sound like PETA. If we're representing the Animal Welfare Institute, we want to sound like the Animal Welfare Institute. So we wanted that flexibility. And for that reason, we still don't have policy positions.
Mm. Joyce, the case of the dog Snowball illustrates one of the big challenges concerning legal standing. Can you explain that incident and what was learned?
Sure. Legal standing, by the way, is the ability to get into court in the first place in order to represent the plaintiff that you're representing. Most of the time we haven't. We don't even think about it. If I get into a car accident, I'm bodily injured, my car is damaged, I have standing to sue. But what about when someone else is abusing or neglecting an animal and the animal is their property? Do I have standing? And in most instances, the ready answer is no, I don't, and I have to find ways to get into court to represent the interests of that animal. The Snowball case involved a Samoyed who had been owned by individuals. He had gotten lost, had gone to a shelter, and the shelter had then sold him to a research laboratory at Stanford University in the Palo Alto Veterans Administration Hospital.
Oh,
and
God.
One evening, a third-year medical student found this dog collapsed on a doorway, and he was obviously in great distress. He had wounds on all four of his legs. His breathing was labored. The medical student couldn't find the campus vet, so he took the dog to an emergency veterinary clinic, and the veterinarian said this dog is in terrible condition. He's not going to he's not going to get any better, and Snowball was euthanized. A necropsy of his body showed emaciation, pneumonia, open and infected wound on all four of his limbs, dehisced, which means open, surgical wounds. It showed that he had been suffering tremendously and was not receiving proper medical care. We found out later that this was not part of the experiment. It was just neglect on the part of the agency that was overseeing the experiments. And so we went to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We were working with three local humane societies who were investigating the incident. The local prosecutor was not interested in taking the case. The U.S. Department of Agriculture was, as usual, not doing very much and dragging its feet. So we decided to sue civilly to try to force the USDA to enforce the Animal Welfare Act and give injunctive and declaratory relief. But the basic issue was we didn't own Snowball, and the court, of course, asked us, what right do you have to come to this court? The court granted the defendant's motion for dismissal, said the Humane Societies did not have standing and that they had failed to set to state a claim. And so that was an early indicator. That was the early 1980s. That was an early indicator of the problems we would later face when we were trying to sue repeatedly under the Animal Welfare Act to provide minimum protections to animals used in research. It was a really sad, sad case for us.
So sad. And now, venturing into livestock issues, another turning point was the Provimi case involving veal.
Yes.
Joyce, what was that all about, and how did it affect ALDF as an organization?
Well, this goes back to 1984 when we were still doing things, most of us, on a volunteer basis. I was the only employee that ALDF had at that time. And back in 1984, people didn't know much about veal calves. Today, I'm sure your audience does know about the problem involving veal calves, which is that the males don't have any purpose in a dairy herd, and so they are put into For some of them, they are put into intensive confinement, removed from their mothers, and they're fed an iron-deficient diet, which causes them to be anemic and sickly, but gives the meat this white color that some consumers prefer. And they're sold as so-called milk-fed veal. That's fine for the farmer and for companies like Provini, which are making a profit, but it's a life of misery for the calves. And so
right. The
question that we faced at that time is, how can we challenge the abuse? Again, we don't own the calves. We have no interest from the perspective of the law. The fact that we might be upset about the treatment, the law doesn't recognize that we have an interest. So we grappled, and the we in this case was we had a chapter in Boston, Massachusetts, led by Steve Wise and Sarah Lewick, who is still on our board of directors. And they spent about a year trying to figure out how to challenge this method of raising these calves. And they came up with an interesting, very innovative idea. They said, we're going to seek injunctive relief to bar Provini from selling this meat because this confinement of calves violates the anti-cruelty laws and the meat is tainted and unhealthy. So it was a consumer protection kind of a case. That was what we were trying to do. It was innovative. However, the court kicked us out of court, said, no, I'm sorry, there is a federal scheme which covers the packaging of meat, and you're trying to do an end run around the cruelty laws. Sorry, you cannot bring this lawsuit.
Mm.
So, you know, one of the lessons we learned from that is that trial judges don't particularly like innovative ideas. Our legal system is built on precedent, and it reveres the status quo. And if we were going to change the way the law views and treats animals, it was going to take time, number one, and we were going to have to find ways to speak to judges in a language that they understand and were willing to accept.
So, Joy, switching gears now, at what point did the American Bar Association begin to recognize animal law as a unique entity?
In the early days of animal law, there were attempts to form an animal law committee as part of the Young Lawyers section of the American Bar, and they introduced a resolution early on, and it was met with whinnies and barks and grunts from the other lawyers at the ABA. It was mortifying, and so that committee did some good things but ceased to exist. And for a long time there was no ABA presence, but not all that long ago, in the mid-2000s, an attorney named Barbara Gislason reintroduced the idea of an animal law committee, but she did it in a different way, a much more mainstream way. She did it through the very conservative tort trial and insurance practice section. And there's now a vibrant, alive, very, very active committee, an animal law committee, which is part of the TIPS section of the ABA. Times have changed, and the ABA is more willing to accept the ideas of animal protection. And the approach that this group has taken has been very successful. They've written several books that have been published by the ABA, and they've gotten several awards for the work that they're doing. So it's pretty exciting. The ABA is a huge organization, very conservative, very mainstream America. And for it to recognize animal law is a major step forward.
Now, Lewis and Clark Law School has played and continues to play a vital role. Can you describe briefly, because we only have a couple minutes left in the segment, what they do? And also, ALDF has a collaboration with them, right?
That's correct, yeah. Lewis and Clark, starting in the early 1990s, had a student named Nancy Perry, who then graduated and went on to HSUS, now is with ASPCA. But Nancy and her colleagues in the law school introduced the first animal law class, the first student ALDF chapter, the first ongoing conference, and an animal law journal. They were very busy while they were in law school. And all of those have continued on to this day. We saw this long history that came, or that was happening at Lewis and Clark, and decided to fund what is the very first robust animal law center. It's called the Center for Animal Law Studies. It now offers 35 separate courses on specific issues involved in animal law, international animal law, criminal animal law, environmental issues. It goes on and on and on. It has visiting professors. It offers the very first LLM program in animal law. This is headed by Pamela Frosch, who's the first associate dean of animal law, and Kathy Hessler, who is an experienced clinician focused on animal law. So these are all firsts. They're very exciting. This is largely funded by Animal Legal Defense Fund, and we're very proud to have this association with Lewis and Clark Law School. And the dean of the law school, Bob Klonoff, has been wonderfully supportive of this.
More with Joyce Tischler on the history of animal law right after the break.
That's the sound of a dog whose vocal cords were cut just to stifle her voice. It's called devocalization, and it's done to cats as well. Devocalized animals rasp and wheeze, cough and gag the rest of their lives. Some are rendered mute. And for what? So a commercial or hobby breeder can keep many animals without having to listen to them. So show dogs will be quiet in transit between shows or in the ring. So an irresponsible pet owner can leave a dog alone for hours every day. Animals today joins with Coalition to Protect and Rescue Pets in saying shame on anyone who would have a dog or cat devocalized, and shame on the vets who perform this inhumane, unnecessary surgery for them. Please speak out against devocalization of dogs and cats. Use your voice. Protect theirs. This message is sponsored by Desert Paws. Visit them at desertpaws.org.
There's no getting around it. The great outdoors isn't so great for your cat. From speeding cars to toxic lawn chemicals, coyotes to cruel humans, cats are no match for the dangers of today's world. The good news is animal behaviorists say cats don't need to go outside to be happy. Your family will be happier and much healthier, too, without the ticks, fleas, diseases, and the dead critters that outdoor cats bring their owners. And you'll never have to explain to a sobbing child who or what hurt her pet or why he hasn't come home. For starters, don't let your kitten out. He won't miss what he doesn't know. But even adult cats can adapt to life indoors. The key is to provide attention, exercise, and a stimulating environment. Play with your cat. You can hide toys around the house, too. Just make sure there are no detachable parts that can be swallowed. Is he still wanting to get out? Consult an animal behaviorist for more tips. Animals Today urges you, don't give up. Right now, today, you can protect your cat from becoming a tragic statistic. Tomorrow may be too late.
This message is brought to you by Desert Paws. Visit us at desertpaws.org.
Hey, guys, remember when you were 18 with boundless energy and the stamina to do anything you wanted, anytime? Wish you could relive your glory days and have the testosterone of your teenage years with the experience and skill you have today? Now you can with Progene Daily Complex.
This is Dr. Todd Karen from the American Academy of Anti-Aging and Regenerative Medicine. Testosterone levels decrease in men after the age of 20. It's a major cause of the aging process. The effects include lack of energy, decrease in muscle mass, increasing belly fat, and decreased sexual performance, all of which impact self-esteem, confidence, and most importantly, overall quality of life.
Kick your drive back into high gear with Progene. Call 800-516-7457 today to get a full month absolutely free. No injections, no prescription needed. Progene is an all-natural herbal supplement that helps men naturally produce more testosterone. Claim your free month supply now by calling 800-516-7457. That's 800-516-7457. Again, 800-516-7457. Shipping and processing fees apply.
E-discovery laws and government regulations require that certain businesses save electronic communication, namely emails, or face potential fines. Barracuda Networks, the world leader in content security, application delivery, and data protection, with more than 130,000 customers worldwide, can help. The Barracuda Message Archiver indexes and preserves all email communication while enforcing policies for regulatory compliance. Save email. Avoid penalties. Visit Barracuda.com/archiver to try the Barracuda Message Archiver free for 30 days. That's Barracuda.com/archiver.
Running a facility, chances are managing inventory isn't your favorite part of the day. Stocking and tracking, ordering and organizing, all necessary evils eating up your time. That's why Grainger's KeepStock services help you manage your inventory more efficiently, from basic labeling and scanning to secure dispensing machines, putting you in total control, often allowing you to buy less, making things seem, well, not so evil anymore. Contact your Grainger representative or visit Grainger.com/KeepStock today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's your gym membership costing you? Do you even use it anymore? If you're looking to save some money and still stay in great shape, then here's a great offer from Total Gym. I have one. I use it every day. It's easy to set up. There's no weights to move around. I work out in 15 minutes a day, and I stay in great shape. And the best part is I don't have to leave my home to get a full intensive
Welcome back
workout.
To the show. We're speaking to Joyce Tischler, and during the break, I was speaking to Joyce how interesting this topic is to me. So we're going to have to bring her on because there's just so much more about the history of animal law that I want to learn, and I'm sure you do too. Joyce, another trend you mentioned in one of your papers was animal welfare groups hiring their own lawyers. When did that begin, and what was the value?
800-460-1140, 800-460-1140, 800-460-1140, 800-460-1140.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking to Joyce Tischler, and during the break, I was speaking to Joyce how interesting this topic is to me. So we're going to have to bring her on because there's just so much more about the history of animal law that I want to learn, and I'm sure you do too. Joyce, another trend you mentioned in one of your papers was animal welfare groups hiring their own lawyers. When did that begin, and what was the value to the groups?
It's been good to see that because it means the groups are giving themselves the capacity to use the tool of litigation. HSUS years ago in the 80s used to rely on outside pro bono counsel, which is good as far as it goes, but you know you can only rely on volunteers for so much. In the mid-2000s, they began to hire attorneys on staff and to have a robust in-house litigation program, and it's been incredibly successful. If you look at the HSUS website and look at all the litigation that they're doing and all of the wins, it speaks for itself. And the same with other groups. PETA has hired in-house counsel, PCRM has, Farm Sanctuary has. So a lot of the biggest major groups are now using attorneys as a tool, you know, as a tool to add to the other tools that they have, such as education, legislation, reaching out to the public. They all need to work together. And for years, these groups didn't realize that. Now they do, and bravo to them.
And many people know about the numerous grants Bob Barker has offered to groups. Do you know how that started?
That started with Bob Barker, who, for reasons that only he understands, decided that a major animal rights push could come from him giving large grants of money. It started with $500,000, then moved up to $1 million, to the biggest, most prestigious law schools in the U.S., and in return, what they had to do was have animal law classes and animal law activities. And that's made a huge impact. It's really helped to mainstream the teaching of animal law, because once the biggest, most prestigious school doing it, then other schools were willing to follow along and introduce animal law classes.
Joyce, I would love it if you can share some of the important lessons you've learned over the years working in animal law.
Oh, there have been many valuable and many painful lessons, and we're still continuing to learn lessons. One is that you need to do high-quality legal work. Passion for animals is not enough. Another is that the long-term development of animal law and the jurisprudence means that you have to be focused. You can't take every issue that walks in the door. Most of the people who come to us with animal law cases are people who are dealing with companion animal issues, because that's where most animals are in our lives, our dogs and cats. But that doesn't mean that those are the animals who are suffering the worst or need the most help. The animals who need the most help in the largest numbers are farmed animals, and that's where the law is absolutely at its weakest. We need to focus our energies so that we can help the most animals the most. We have to be persistent. We have to be opportunistic. We have to constantly do research and see what is it that we could build on, what states could we be going to, where in the federal jurisprudence could we be focused. the legal system doesn't change our society. There's a very interesting interplay between progress that you make in court and progress that you make in the in public opinion. And we have to be sensitive as lawyers to how far we can push and how fast. And I've said to people, we need to study the social movements for human beings and the environmental movement and see what applies to us and what does not. If our society is going to be ready for a change, it's going to happen. But if it's not, it's not going to happen. And I think, you know, if you look at other movements, if you look at the death penalty movement, the abortion movement, we can learn lessons from them, as well as the civil rights movement and environmentalism. We can learn lessons from those other movements and apply them to our own. And we need to do that. We need to be students of history. We need breakthrough decisions. We need to be successful, because if you lose, it doesn't establish the law that you need to move on and build on that precedent. We are only beginning to explore the legal theories that we're going to be able to argue to provide greater protection for animals, and I think our most exciting achievements are yet to come.
Great. Joyce, what do you feel are the upcoming opportunities in animal law, and what do you think the most formidable challenges will be?
We still face the challenge of standing, and that continues to plague us and will, I think, for a long time. The challenges are the mindset of the human beings who control and exploit animals, and changing society has never been easy. It will never be easy. I think we have to work hard, realize that progress is always going to be slower than we would like it to be, and hold on tight to a vision of a world in which animals are not exploited and terrorized and tortured, a vision of a world in which the rights and interests of all sentient beings are respected within the legal system and by our society.
Joyce, tell my listeners about your website.
You can learn more about the work that Animal Legal Defense Fund does at www.aldf.org.
Joyce Tischler, thank you so much for all the wonderful work you and ALDF is doing for the animals.
Thank you, Lori. Thanks for listening.
Well, very fascinating, Lori. A nice complete rundown on some of those great historical points. And it's remarkable how recent all this is. You know, we'd sort of take for granted it's always been this way, but it really hasn't. It started recently, and it's just grown and grown, and every year another crop of lawyers is hatched.
Yeah.
And they are out there, a lot of them interested, you know, in these legal issues and willing to take this on.
It really is incredible just to think 40 years ago or so this all started, and the class is even more recent, in the last decade.
Yeah. You know, one of the most remarkable things in all this really is the power of Bob Barker.
Yeah.
It's really incredible to just dole out large chunks of money to accomplish specific goals.
Kirshner, encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.
The opinions you hear on the Business Talk Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of this station, Business Talk Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Business Talk Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Investing involves risks, so please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about the Business Talk Radio Network, contact us at 203-323-7300 or at our website, businesstalkradio.net.
USA Radio News, I'm John Russell. A spokesman for Billy Graham says the 93-year-old evangelist has been admitted to a North Carolina hospital for an infection in his lungs.